Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
Open the door to huge savings now at Menards. Enhance the appearance of your home with a new stylish garage door. Choose from our large in-stock selection of ideal garage doors or design your own using our free garage door designer in-store or on Menards.com. Save big on ideal garage doors. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at
Close friends and neighbours all testified that the Van Breeders were a strong Christian, tight-knit family. They lived a really privileged life in a really picturesque part of South Africa, and it was surrounded by gorgeous vineyards. They had a seemingly perfect life. However, by the morning of the 27th of January 2015, Henry Van Breeder's parents and older brother had been mercilessly murdered. His younger sister rushed to hospital with severe head injuries, whilst he remained basically unscathed to tell the tale. This is a strong reminder that you never know what goes on behind closed doors. This is the case of Henry Van Breeder. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
Terms and conditions apply.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Dive Crime Podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. So, the Van Breeder family, first of all, they came from a really affluent background. So they lived, in my opinion, a really idyllic lifestyle. Both parents were still together. We had Martin, who's 54, and Teresa, who's 55. They came historically from a very wealthy background. They were well-established families in South Africa. And Henry Van Breeder, who is one of their children, he had what can only be described as an incredibly privileged upbringing. And his upbringing was actually along Australia's Sunshine Coast, which is absolutely stunning. I wish I was there right now, if I'm honest. Henry had an older brother called Rudy. He was 22, and he had a younger sister, Marley, who was aged just 16. Now, the Van Breeder family had obviously emigrated to Australia, but then in January 2014, the family emigrated back to South Africa. And at the time, they moved to the exclusive De Sales Golf Estate. And the reason for that is they wanted to be closer to the mother's family. I looked up that golf estate. It is a place I would like to live. So we're talking very privileged, very beautiful, very nice lifestyle. And as I said, idyllic up until the point that we're going to cover today. Neighbours and close family members, in fact, described Henry Van Breeder as being the black sheep of the family. So essentially, his siblings, when compared to him, they thrived. So they were brilliant at school, they were fantastic at university. And he had actually dropped out. So he hadn't necessarily followed the same route as his siblings. And obviously, that can be really problematic when you are in a family of successful people, because arguably, you want to be in a scenario where your family consider that you are succeeding. And I think it can be quite a pressurized experience when you are failing compared to the siblings that you have. So I imagine that for Henry Van Breeder, it would have been quite problematic for him psychologically, realizing that as a comparison, he wasn't doing as well as his older brother or even his younger sister sibling. Now, he also had some other issues. So it's reported that Van Breeder was a drug addict, and the police believe that he was addicted to the drug Tic. Now, Tic is more commonly known as crystal meth. For those of you who don't know a lot about crystal meth, well, actually, what I would say is have a look at crystal meth before and after pictures. I think if ever there is a drug that is so indicative of destruction, it's literally exposed on the faces of those who take it. You will see pictures online of individuals who didn't take the drug and then had a period, not even a very long period of taking that drug, and it ages them about 50 years. And that is not an exaggeration. It literally destroys them physically. Now, if you're wealthy, I do appreciate that the incidence of you falling from grace in the way that you would do if you were an ordinary person who then needs to start stealing, for example, to pay for their habit, the chances are the impact on you physically might not be as obvious to other people, but over time, I promise you, it is absolutely catastrophic. So one of the things that this drug does is, aside from being extremely addictive, is it lowers inhibitions. It tends to sharpen your senses, but also is very known for fueling aggression. So it can be a drug that if you take it, it will make you act outside the normal realms of your moral and ethical behavior. It's a really horrible, horrible drug. But because it gives such a rush of feeling, because it does indeed make you more confident, and because it is incredibly addictive as well, whilst on an economical level, you're going to have to be able to afford it, on a psychological level, you're going to crave it because it makes you into a person that you aren't ordinarily. So he has this issue with this very, very addictive drug. Now, during the course of the investigation that we're going to cover today, the police actually tracked down Van Breeder's drug runner. He was called Mark, and he lived in a town which was just 200 metres from the esteemed Dizzle's golf estate. So he's a perfect person because, really, it means that Van Breeder can literally get drugs at any point in time that he wants. And of course, he's got access to the finances, which makes the repetitive nature of the addiction far more easy to actually satiate. So they identify this guy, they identify that he is very much taking a high level of this drug. And even though he didn't, as a drug dealer, know Van Breeder's name, he knew his face. He knew that he was a very, very regular customer. So clearly Van Breeder is struggling. Yes, he has an addiction, but also what is that saying about who he is and what he's trying to potentially escape from? When you are a drug dependent, it tends to be that you are trying to run from something, or you don't like yourself to some degree, so you anesthetize some of those feelings using the drug. The fact that this particular drug makes you feel super confident, even though it can also antagonize your aggression level, it does suggest that he liked being the person that he was when he was experiencing the highs that that drug gave him. Now, in 2014, so this is a year actually before the murders that we're going to talk about today played out, it was reported that Van Breeder spent time in a rehab. It was a very upmarket drug rehabilitation centre in a place called Belleville. But nonetheless, it demonstrates that this was getting out of control. Now, whether the impetus for him going to that particular rehabilitation centre was driven by his family, or whether it was elected that he was struggling on a personal level and wanted the help, I can't tell you. I would imagine it's more likely that the family paid for it, and it's more likely that the family were the ones pushing him in the right direction, believing that he needed the help and support and resources to overcome this addiction. So let's go to the early hours of 27th of January 2015, when an emergency call is put in by Van Breeder to emergency services.
Okay, what kind of injuries is this?
My family and me were attacked by an axe.
With an axe. Okay, unconscious, it is. Unconscious, huh?
Yes, and bleeding from the head.
When the paramedics turned up, one of them was called Christian Kogelberg, and he attended the scene at the time to try to help what had unfolded as an incredible tragedy. And he said that he literally saw the worst thing that he had seen in his 39-year career. Now, come on. One, it's in South Africa, and levels of crime in South Africa are higher than, for example, in the UK, and violent crime is also higher. And therefore, you could imagine that a paramedic is going to have seen some pretty terrible things in his time. Out of 39 years, this hands down was the worst. In fact, he described something that I think is so powerful and so traumatic and devastating. He said, blood ran like a waterfall down the stairs. I mean, that conjures an image straight out of a horror movie, doesn't it? Blood ran like a waterfall down the stairs. And it was obvious from the very get-go of investigating this particular set of murders that the extent of the injuries to each of the victims meant that there was absolutely no way the assailant didn't want to kill them. There was a full intention to kill these individuals. So obviously, Henry Van Breeder is the person who's called in these series of events that have led to his family being absolutely brutalised, because that's what's happened. Henry Van Breeder's family have been horrifically, violently and devastatingly attacked, and yet Henry Van Breeder is actually still standing, essentially. So obviously, when there is a surviving witness and victim, the police are desperate to find out exactly what had played out according to them. So Henry Van Breeder actually describes to the police what happened. And bear in mind, you've heard the emergency services call now, and I'm sure that you felt a little bit disconcerted by it, because we expect a certain reaction to a certain set of events. It's as simple as that. And when you listen to Van Breeder actually talk on the phone to emergency services, what you feel is there is a mismatch. He doesn't express himself as if he's panicking, as if he's traumatized, as if he's shocked and numb. There is a formulaic way that he deals with the situation, and that is as if he was just talking to somebody that was asking him a series of questions when he's got a complete normal temperament. Because his responses are incredibly gathered, very calm, collected, but also there's almost a laugh at the very beginning, you know, a disbelief kind of laugh, which is a mismatch from how you would be if indeed you'd just been a victim of a serious crime and your family were bleeding out in your home to a point where, as I said, the paramedic describes a waterfall of blood. And that's our first little chip away at the potential story that Van Breeder is going to give the police. Now, another thing that happens is when the emergency services arrive and the police come, they find Van Breeder in a very odd state. So he's incredibly calm. He's dressed in pajama shorts, he's dressed in white socks. Both of these are literally soaked in blood. And it turns out that when they analyse those items, the blood doesn't belong to him, it's the DNA of his parents and his brother. Van Breeder also goes ahead and gives a statement, which is very soon after the incident. That's normal. Obviously, investigators want to find out exactly what you've seen in the moment, because as time moves on, particularly where trauma is concerned, it can mean that people almost black out certain memories because it's just too triggering, terrifying and painful to return to. The brain becomes overwhelmed and it shuts down certain memories. So getting that information very quickly is paramount. So Van Breeder says that as far as he remembers, a well-built black intruder wearing gloves and a balaclava was to blame. Now, I think probably all of you will be aware that it's kind of convenient for him to throw in this idea of this well-built black intruder, because South Africa does have a really high crime rate, and to some degree it's believable that somebody has broken in, particularly to a very affluent home. House breakings are actually number one for a recorded crime in South Africa. But he's bringing in black man because there is, I feel, still undercurrent of people having particular biases towards black communities in South Africa and seeing them as more likely to commit crime, and therefore believing that if you say it was a black man who did this, that the individuals who are investigating the crime will buy into it more and believe it more because of that bias. And it also says something about Van Breeder and his personal inclination regarding his feelings, shall we say, to other communities that in this case are non-white. And the fact that he is bringing this in again, when you consider what I'm going to tell you shortly, what does that say about his character? Because clearly it seems like he's trying to deflect away from any suspicion that could be pointed to him as being a problem within this crime scene. So right from the get-go, the investigators are feeling a little bit suspicious, shall we say, about Van Breeder. Now, as they further question him, he says that he was actually attacked last, and he was in the bathroom, allegedly, when the attacks began. Apparently, he remained frozen, just watching his family being massacred before his eyes by this axe-wielding maniac who just laughed before he then goes ahead and produces a knife and stabs Henry Van Breeder in the torso. Now, I just want you to think about that for a moment. So we're expected to believe that Van Breeder has witnessed these horrendous attacks. He's watched his family be slaughtered in front of his eyes. He's frozen. Now, that wouldn't be something that's unusual. I mean, people freeze all the time in horribly traumatic situations. But this guy's got an axe. Why would this man, who's apparently gone around the house murdering the entire family, or at least attempting to murder the entire family, why would he be like, oh, I'm just going to put this axe down now, I'm going to get this knife? The change of weapon is a really strange addition to this story. Yeah, if he'd gone up to Van Breeder and actually used the axe on him several times and he'd survived, that would be something that was plausible. But apparently he just puts the axe down, produces a knife. Like I said, there's an implausibility of a random weapon change. You know, this is not how a perpetrator who is carrying such a weapon would act in this situation at all. And also the fact that he kind of says that he laughs. Again, is that how this kind of individual would be? Because he would be frenzied. He's swinging an axe at these innocent people. Why would he be laughing whilst changing a weapon? Again, it just doesn't make sense to me at all. And then there's a real inconsistency, and that is the amount of time it takes Van Breeder to actually ring emergency services. Because it turns out that his first instinct isn't to actually call for help, but it's to call his then 16-year-old girlfriend, Bianca. Now, she didn't answer, but apparently after he'd called her, inconveniently, he just passes out on the stairs. So he manages to get his phone, call his girlfriend, she doesn't answer, and unfortunately, as opposed to then calling emergency services and actually getting help for his family that are bleeding out, he just happens to pass out. Then apparently he regains consciousness nearly 3 hours later. I mean, I'm all for a story where somebody faints in shock or faints because something awful's occurred. But with respect, fainting and passing out for 3 hours, this guy hasn't lost half of his blood. It makes no sense. And then apparently at this point, when he comes around, he calls the police. So when they start to actually investigate the crime scene, they start to piece together how they think the murders occurred. So the investigators believe that Rudy, his brother, was attacked first, and they believe he was attacked when he was sleeping in bed. He's found with 4 catastrophic axe wounds to the head. When they found his father's body, that also had deep wounds on his back. So Martin had been hit with the axe in his back, and the belief is that he was actually trying to protect Rudy. He was wanting to shield him from whoever this axe-wielding attacker was. And that's testament to Martin and the kind of protective father that he was, that he literally threw himself in front of whoever this murderous killer was to try to stop his son being attacked so horribly. Now, the mother and sister, they got attacked last. And of all the victims, it seems that Marley, she put up the greatest fight. She had extensive head injuries. She had self-defense wounds. And Marley, unbelievably, survived. So in spite of the fact that she's been so horribly wounded, and certainly the person who's gone out of their way to try to kill her certainly wanted her dead and believed that she would be dead, the reality is, by some miracle, and it has to be a miracle, She literally survives it. Now, Marley had to go through extensive surgery, extensive physiotherapy after the attack, and I'm imagining a lot of therapy. And she was also left with something called retrograde amnesia, and that meant that she had literally no memory of the night at all. And the problem there is, of course, she would have been able to identify who her perpetrator was, but she couldn't remember it. She was unable to testify in court because it just wasn't something that she could recount and recollect. So the investigators are now dealing with three dead bodies, one individual where there was an attempted murder over, and an individual who has reported this all happening but hasn't seemingly been badly injured and also conveniently passed out for enough time to ensure that everybody died. I know that his sister survived, but the point is that 3 hours, that could have been the difference between life and death of the other parties in this case. Now, as investigators begin to explore it further, obviously they start to question Van Breda's version of events because things just don't seem to be adding up at all. So first of all, why is the perpetrator of this attack allowed Van Breda to actually survive? And also, why on earth would they have just inflicted such limited injuries in comparison to the rest of the family, who were absolutely targeted in a way that suggested their attacker intended to show them no mercy whatsoever? And so the police start to speak to people who know the family, and they start with the neighbours. They want to ask them what their thoughts were about the relationships that were going on within the family itself. They wanted to be aware about whether they'd seen anything or heard anything or could give them any information whatsoever that could eventually bring the killer to justice. And it turns out they did. So first of all, on the night of the murder, the family were heard having a deeply intense argument. Neighbours testified to hearing some really loud shouting, some aggressive voices that were coming from the house. And this happened before people were going to bed, essentially. So it would quieten down. People were turning in for the night. But nonetheless, it sounded like a really vicious argument. And if you think about the neighbours hearing this, and we're talking about homes that are really decent size, so that meant that it must have been very, very loud. It just starts to make you think, well, this seems a little bit coincidental that essentially this terrible racial row has occurred. And then a few hours later, pretty much everyone in the household is dead. But we're expected to believe that this is because some black man broke into the house and conveniently killed everyone apart from Van Breda. Also, when you think about the attack itself, the fact that it's considered a bloodbath, one could say, well, it's coincidence. It is possible that somebody broke in and as a family, you've had a row before that. And also the way that the Van Breda family were actually murdered, for me, it's quite intimate. You know, the rage level that's required to actually take...
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
This Father's Day at Lowe's, score free gifts for the greatest dad. Right now, get a free select DeWalt, Craftsman, or Kobalt tool with purchase of a select battery kit. Plus, get a free Werner 2-foot aluminum ladder when you buy an 8-foot fiberglass ladder. Shop these deals and more this Father's Day at Lowe's. We help, you save. Valid through 6/15 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
An axe to people, it's not something that would be a choice of weapon for most individuals. Certainly, there are far easier methods of killing people than using an axe. I think there's a lot of room for error in that situation. And if you're a perpetrator of a violent crime, particularly one who's comfortable with those violent crimes, I don't think you're going to be using an axe at all. But if you're rageful towards these individuals because you actually have a relationship with them and you ultimately feel so incensed and so angry that you want to destroy them, then using an axe and inflicting such grotesque injuries, that makes more sense. Because, like I said, we can't say it wasn't just a coincidence that this horrible row has occurred and now everybody's dead nearly. But for me, there is a clear link there just with that happening prior to these murders being carried out, and also the weapon used and the rage that had to follow within the feeling to actually go ahead and do that. Now, Van Breeder says that he was attacked last. He said that he was in the bathroom. He said that he'd been frozen, but he doesn't give any explanation as to why he wasn't also attacked in the way that his family were attacked. It just seems incongruent with what we would expect when we think about how this would have played out if this had authentically been an individual who'd come in, probably to do a home invasion, potentially to steal whatever they could get, and to firstly annihilate the entire family to ensure no witnesses were available. Leaving a witness that you've laughed in their face of, that you've murdered their family in front of, and that you then just stabbed once and left alive, that's going to mean that you are far more likely to get caught and incarcerated for really, really serious crimes that are going to mean that you never get to walk the streets again. Why would a perpetrator do that? It just doesn't fit with our understanding of criminality in the way that we would expect it to if what Van Breeder was saying was true. Now, we get to the 13th of June 2016. This is after a year and a half of investigations. Henry goes and he hands himself into the police because obviously they've been making it clear that as far as they're concerned, he is the individual who is guilty of this crime. He's immediately released on bail of £4,000 essentially the next day. So that's the amount that needs to be paid. And the reason for that is, even though one could imagine that he was somebody who was likely to try to flee and potentially had the financial means to do so, for whatever reason, they don't believe that he is likely to actually go ahead and do that. So even though he's gone in, he's turned himself into the authorities, he's basically been immediately bailed so he can go and carry on with his life. Then we get to the 4th of April 2017. So that's nearly a year where he's just been walking the streets freely. Even though this is hanging over his head, he has been getting on with his life as usual. At this point, the state trial against Henry Van Breeder begins. Now, bear in mind, as I've said, he has been the police's only suspect throughout the entire investigation. They do not believe that anybody else has been capable of this killing. They 100% believe that he's banged to rights. They think there are so many inconsistencies in his story that a jury is going to be able to hear the evidence and find him guilty. So when the court case begins, he pleads not guilty and he maintained his innocence throughout the 67-day trial. Now, the prosecution, I think they did a good job. I don't think this was a particularly difficult case to try because I think that they had so many numerous inconsistencies in Van Breeder's testimony and they had a lot of circumstantial evidence that weighed up together to give quite a compelling case against Van Breeder. So these are some of the inconsistencies and the circumstances that they felt would lead to him being found guilty. So first of all, there was literally nothing to suggest that an intruder was in the house. And I mean, that's the problem, isn't it? You kind of think if there is a murderous individual who's coming with the intention of wiping out the entire family, they're probably going to have left some marks, right? But no. So there's no signs of forced entry. There were no valuables taken. Can you see where this is going? At the end of the day, he said it was an intruder who'd come into the home. And home invasions are enormous in that area, therefore it kind of is contextual, and yet nothing has been taken. Also, security experts at the trial said Houdini couldn't have broken into the Van Breeder's home. Not my quote, that's the experts. Unfortunately, we won't be able to test that theory as Houdini is dead. But clearly, they are a very affluent family living in an area where they could be under threat because people do go into homes and steal, particularly from affluent households. So the consequences are that they made sure that their home was like Fort Knox. So getting in there without invite would have been implausible, if not impossible. And Dezulle's golf estate is actually considered one of the safest places to live in South Africa. It had CCTV, it had motion detectors, it had an alarm system, it had 24-hour guard patrol, and even an electric fence. I mean, if you can break in there, then the CIA need to borrow you, because clearly you're the right person for a lot of jobs. And whatever has gone on for Van Breda in making the decision that he clearly made, which was to abuse and murder his family, he's not thought consequentially about where this is going. So there is immediacy level, which is, I'm really angry with my family. I'm feeling like rageful towards them, and I'm going to actually harm them horribly. That's a place of passion and anger, aggression, rage. And that's what directs the killing. That's what incites the killing. But if you haven't done the maths and actually thought about the likelihood and logistics of getting away with that, then you're going to be reacting from that point onwards and trying to create a story that fits a narrative, as opposed to creating the narrative before and then working towards a scenario where it looks like you're innocent even if you're guilty. He's failed to do any of that. This is a reactive reality. And that goes back to that very first phone call where he's speaking to the emergency services, because you just get the feeling that he's highly unprepared for what he needs to do and say. And that unpreparedness is why his story has fell apart so easily. Now, when he's asked in court, why would an intruder break in to the Van Breeders' luxurious home and then just ignore all the valuable items? Bear in mind, it's a bit like The Great Escape. This individual has managed to overcome all of these security services, the fence, the alarms, the motion sensors, the CCTV, managed to actually get into the home, and it would be far easier to get into somebody else's home, wouldn't it? And bear in mind, this isn't personal because they don't know the Van Breeders. Therefore, this isn't somebody purposefully coming to kill them because it's some kind of a hit. And if you think about all of the obstacles in the way of that individual, they could have easily broken into somebody else's place and position where they had an opportunity to steal from them or kill them if they wanted to, without all of these problematic realities that's been created by this place being one of the safest places in South Africa. So why would they do all of that and then take nothing? It just makes no sense whatsoever. They ignored valuable items that were all downstairs and instead went on this apparent killing spree. Now, when he's asked by the prosecution about that, he just couldn't provide an answer. Also, how does Henry Van Breda end up without the wounds that his family ended up with? I mean, every single other family member was either horrifically injured or killed. And the experts who analysed the victim's wounds said they all came from one attacker, and that that one attacker used the same equal force on each victim. So why would they change their typology of killing? You know, it's been the same for every single person. Why would Van Breda suddenly be knifed instead of attacked by an axe? It doesn't add up. Also, a forensic pathologist proved that the knife wounds that Henry Van Breda actually received were self-inflicted. So they were all superficial and they were all uniform injuries. Also, there was no signs of bruising. There was no signs of self-defense. And you have to think, if somebody's coming at you with a knife, particularly if you have just literally witnessed them destroy and mutilate your family members with an axe, when they are coming towards you, whether you've frozen or otherwise, the instinct that you have when somebody raises a knife is either to go for the knife to try to deflect it or to cover your body in the area that you think it's going to go in. That's why we constantly see defense wounds when an individual is aware they're about to be attacked. It's a natural instinct. It's primordial. It's protective. It's reactive. None of that exists. And that in itself demonstrates that he was ready for the injury. And in this case, that he was committing the injury himself. Then there's the forensic analysis of the blood splatters at the actual crime scene and on Henry Van Breda's shorts and socks. So Susan Galloway, she was the lead prosecutor. I bet she was having a field day. Even the things I've just said to you, you automatically know that if you were a prosecuting lawyer, this is just a dream come true. Because you absolutely want to bring people to justice. You want individuals who have mercilessly killed others to be locked up for a long time, if not forever. And when you are given a case to prosecute and there are so many inconsistencies in the story and this like blindingly obvious reality that the individual who's on the stand is actually lying and that you can unpick their lies, it must be quite exhilarating to some degree because you know that you're going to get justice and you know that that person is going to have to pay for what they did. So Susan Galloway, she actually states that his statement of having been in the bathroom was a lie. And the reason for that is there were no traces of blood around the bathroom door. So if there's no traces of blood around the bathroom door, then how on earth were Henry Van Breeder's socks and shorts so grotesquely covered in blood? Remember what the paramedic said at the beginning, it was a waterfall of blood on the stairs. He mustn't have been in the bathroom at all. Otherwise, there would have been blood everywhere because he was covered in it. So she instead said that as far as they were concerned, the prosecution believed that that evening, just as the neighbours had testified, there was a horrible argument. Maybe it was about Henry Van Breeder's drug use. Maybe it was because he was falling short in his life. Maybe it was because his family felt that they were having to prop him up whilst he was making these awful decisions. And that in particular, there was a potential chance that he was rowing awfully with his brother. And that Henry Van Breeder, for whatever reason, snapped. So that's why the injuries to his brother, where his father essentially threw himself in front of Henry Van Breeder, who's attacking Rudy, that's why he would have thrown himself in front of him, because it would have been a situation that had suddenly got out of hand. Henry Van Breeder had got the axe, gone to attack Rudy, and his father, wanting to protect his other son, had basically sacrificed himself in that moment. So not that it was heavily premeditated, but that he snapped, and the consequence of that snapping is that once it started, it just went down that road. So when his father got involved, essentially there was absolutely no going back. And of course, when he's killed Rudy and his father, there are now two other witnesses, his sister and his mother, so he believes, well, in for a penny, in for a pound, I may as well kill them as well. That prosecutor also said that Henry Van Breeder was incredibly arrogant.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
The court papers stated, it's believed that after the commission of the crimes, the accused tampered with the crime scene, inflicted injuries to his person, and supplied false information to the police in order to mislead the police as to the true identity of the perpetrator. The prosecution further argued that Henry had waited for his family to bleed to death before ringing for help. And like I said, there was a 3-hour gap. And a lot can happen in those 3 hours. And the fact that he just, shall we say, coincidentally collapsed, even though he hadn't lost loads of blood, and even though he managed to speak to his 16-year-old girlfriend, somehow he didn't manage to call emergency services. So all of this together on a circumstantial level looks very, very bad for Henry Van Breeder. In particular, the fact that he's pretended that he was in the bathroom and yet he's literally covered in blood and that isn't his, evidencing that he could not have been in the bathroom when he got stabbed. And they do a very good job as a prosecution of painting that picture of an individual who isn't a victim, but instead is a ruthless killer. Now, I believe that at this point, when you consider what I've told you so far, he's bound to rights. I mean, a jury is going to listen to that evidence and believe that there is compelling reason to actually send him down. But not everybody felt that way. So one of the people who stoically and consistently protected him as far as his reputation, as far as their consideration of him as a good person, is his girlfriend, Danielle Jans von Ransberg. She fully believed his story. She refuses to accept that he's a murderer. But again, when you think about what happens to him 2 months after he's released on bail, he's actually arrested with that very girlfriend in possession of cannabis. And that demonstrates a lack of regard for what's expected of him whilst he's on bail. You don't want to be breaching and breaking the law when you're trying to prove you're innocent of doing some pretty heinous things, because first of all, it shows an absolute lack of connection with authority. It shows very poor thinking on a logic level and consequentially. And it means that potentially you believe that you're above the law, which are all things that speak into that arrogance, overconfidence and superiority. Now, the girlfriend in this case, she believes that it's Van Breda's epilepsy and that impairs his memory, and it explains all these unbelievably convenient inconsistencies in his story and the fact that she thinks he had a seizure and that's why it took so long to alert the police to his family's attack. And I do have some sympathy and empathy with her, because I appreciate that when you love somebody and you see the best in them and they've been really kind to you and you've never seen that alter side of them, then arguably you're going to want to believe the best. But again, her idea about him having a seizure, this is actually contradicted with much stronger evidence. So the pattern of blood splatter, blood droplets on Henry Van Breda's chest, they didn't change. So if he'd passed out unconscious, undoubtedly, those blood splatter patterns would likely have been smudged. And the expert in this case suggested that the only way it could have happened is if he passed out sitting upright, which I don't know about you. Sounds a little bit impossible to me. I can imagine if people could manage to pass out upright, they probably wouldn't ever need to have an ambulance called because they'd injured themselves falling over. In fact, I can't even imagine it would be that much of an issue if you just had seizures and passed out upright. So again, it just doesn't make sense. And that's what the jury are going to look for. Does this make sense? Could this actually be a reality? And the strong reality is no. They get to the verdict. So on the 21st of May, 2018, Henry Van Breda is found guilty on 3 counts of murder, 1 count of attempted murder and obstructing the course of justice. He's immediately taken into custody, and at this point he was transferred to Polesmoor Prison. Then the sentencing happens on the 7th of June 2018, and in that sentencing he was given 3 life sentences and a separate 15-year sentence for the attempted murder of his younger sister. Also another 1-year sentence for obstructing the course of justice. And the judge stated that the brutality of his attack showed an unprecedented disregard for his family. We get to the 7th of November 2018. At this point, Henry Van Breda has asked to appeal his sentence, but the Supreme Court of Appeal dismisses the application. Why? Because clearly, if ever somebody deserved to go to prison for a very, very long time, it's Henry Van Breda who mercilessly attacked and murdered his family and then tried to pervert the course of justice by making out that he was also a victim. You could not get more dangerous than an individual who starts an unprovoked attack on a member of a family and then potentially decides to protect his own freedom to murder every other member, or at least try to in this case. And what does that say about his life and the privilege and the opportunities that he's been given by his family members? His parents loved him. They protected him. They gave him every privilege that he could have ever dreamt of in his world and life. And this is how he repays them? To destroy them in the most brutal of ways. Now, I've looked up how Henry Van Breda is doing, and it seems that prison does not agree with him. He's really struggling. And if you think about his background, you think about how he's been brought up, you consider the privilege he's experienced, of course, prison is going to be absolutely horrific. Aside from the fact that he isn't allowed his freedom, you just have to think about the food he'll be eating, the people he'll be spending his time with, the fear that he probably walks around with on a daily basis. But he did the crime. And that means that he has to do the time. And you can't feel sorry for somebody like this, because the capacity and capability for grotesque harm that they carry within their nature is astonishing. Now, in June 2018, his legal team actually claimed that he was attacked by 5 inmates. Apparently, he was eventually rescued by a fellow inmate who ripped a metal condom dispenser from the wall and used it as a weapon. But it was a very serious attack. Then in June 2022, Henry Van Breda is actually relocated from Drakenstein Correctional Center.
Ryan Seacrest here. When you have a busy schedule, it's important to maximize your downtime. One of the best ways to do that is by going to ChumbaCasino.com. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino games like spin slots, bingo, and solitaire that you can play for free for a chance to redeem some serious prizes. So hop on to ChumbaCasino.com now and live the Chumba life. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
To Leeuwkop prison, and that's following an attack in prison alleged by a member of the Number Gang who basically split Henry's skull open with a padlock. And one of the things that Henry Van Breeder actually refused to do was to press charges against his assailant. I'm not surprised, because snitches get stitches, and it seems that Henry Van Breeder is getting enough stitches anyway. But you can understand that he's a deeply unpopular individual. He will be so different from the other inmates that he's going to stand out like a sore thumb. When you think about the motive of this crime, because it is incomprehensible when you consider the fact that he was given everything by his parents, he had a lovely life, he would still have had a lovely life. They didn't abandon him, they didn't reject him. Yes, they judged him, but that's what parents do. You love your children, but you also feel unhappy when they do things that they shouldn't do, for example, drugs. But when you think about motive, I imagine that there were certain motivating factors that led him to snap. So it could have been the drugs and the fact that he was taking this particular strength of crystal meth. It could be that he felt really jealous of his successful siblings, and that was a thing that tripped him into that murderous spree. Or it could also be the £12 million fortune that he would have stood to inherit as the sole survivor of a vicious family attack. And I think probably it's a combination of all those three. I think definitely the money would have motivated him. I think he was probably really rageful towards his brother, who was more successful than him. I think that he felt resentment towards his parents because they reminded him that he wasn't succeeding in the way that they expected. And certainly I imagine £12 million was a very strong motivating factor in making him feel that there would be a reward at the end of him going ahead and carrying out these violent crimes. It all went wrong, and because of that, he's lost his freedom. Because of that, he's in a dangerous situation day in, day out with other convicts who don't like him because he's so different. And the likelihood of him ever walking the streets again is very, very limited. Henry Van Breeder made a catastrophic choice, but it came from a place of arrogance, superiority, and entitlement. And the problem with that is those very qualities when you're incarcerated are the qualities that can essentially cause you great harm. Because the power that you would have experienced on the outside with all of those privileges and opportunities, they don't translate day in, day out when you're incarcerated. In fact, they are the things that make you stand out and make other prisoners feel that you deserve punishment just for being who you used to be. And for Henry Van Breeder, I imagine that for the rest of his days, there will be moments that he deeply regrets his actions. Maybe not because he regrets the actual murder of his family, but he regrets the consequences of the loss of his freedom and the loss of his privilege. And that's something that I hope he ruminates on day in, day out, ad infinitum. Because what he did was despicable, grotesque, and absolutely unnecessary beyond belief. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.